Good morning, everyone. We're going to start our meeting today with the project on insurance. And I believe Alessandro will introduce this next session.
Yes, thank you, Leslie. Good morning. So today we have our second and last education session on the practical implementation of an explicit risk adjustment. We have two presentations with three presenters, Tony Coleman from Lonergan, Edwards & Associates, Mark Swallow and Leopoldo Camara from Swiss Re. So welcome and thank you for taking time to hold this session for us today. So in the first presentation, Tony will guide us through the practice in Australia of determining risk margins with a specific focus on P&C business. Tony is currently non-executive director and chairman of the audit committee at AMP Life, and he's also a former chief risk officer and group actuary at the Insurance Australia Group, and he has been a member of the Insurance Working Group for the ISB since 2004. In the second presentation, Mark and Leopoldo will bring us their experience at Swiss Re with determining risk margins within an economic valuation model. Mark has recently taken up a new role as CFO of Swiss Re's European reinsurance business. Before that, he held a number of roles in finance. He is also a former chief accounting officer, and he was also a member of the insurance working group at the ISB. Leopoldo is head of economic value management at Swiss Re. He has a broad experience in the insurance industry, has been working for a number of multinational companies in Germany, Mexico, and Switzerland, and he was also working for the Mexican insurance regulator. So with that, I would like to hand it over to Tony for his presentation, which is an agenda paper 12A, FASB memo 61A. Before that, our presenters will be happy to take questions as we go through the presentations, but at the same time, we may want to save time for a broader discussion at the end of both presentations. So, to you, Tony.
Well, thank you, Alessandro, for that introduction, and thank you also for the opportunity to share today some of the experience we've had in this area in the Australian market. I'm going to work through the slides which I understand have been presented or previously to all of you on the assumption that so you've had a chance to read them, but just try to highlight some of the key issues that might not be immediately obvious just from reading the slides. Basically go through a very brief background on how the Australian insurance industry got to the point that it has now, and then explain a bit about how the methodology we've used in Australia in this area, particularly around expected values of liabilities for insurance and risk margins, actually works, and share what some of the developments have been as a result of that, particularly around issues that I think are important to the boards, things like comparability between companies and between different years of different companies' performance, and also consistency and the methods of reproduction. So if we move to slide three, basically, if I can just make the observation that in a sense the Australian market is almost like a pilot study for many of the issues that the boards are contemplating putting in place with the new International Accounting Standard for Insurance. I'll come later to a bit of brief comparison between particularly the Australian Accounting Standard for non-life insurance and the exposure draft that was issued last year. You will see that there are a great many similarities. But firstly, just very quickly, the Australian insurance market is actually about the 10th largest in the world. It's about 2% of global non-life premium income, and it has 132 companies actually operating in the market. There are basically four very large companies, which of course implies that there are quite a large number, well over 100, which we would regard as quite small companies. And all of those companies have had to follow this methodology by law in Australia since January 2005, so for the last 6 years. If I move now to slide four, essentially there's probably one other couple of key points about the Australian industry. There's one company in particular and a couple of others that probably should also be mentioned, but QBE in particular, although it's an Australian-controlled and based company, only about less than a third of its actual business is in Australia and New Zealand. It writes business in over 47 countries around the world. It's a major player in the Lloyd's market in London. It has major businesses in both North and South America. The point is that all of those businesses have had to adopt, at the consolidated level for QBE, Australian accounting methodology. So at least in that company, and also in IAG, which operates in seven countries, different countries outside Australia, those two companies have had to apply this methodology for all of their businesses worldwide. So it's not just something that applies in Australia. There's nothing particularly unusual about the non-Australian non-life insurance market, just about all of the policies that you would normally expect to find anywhere in the world will be found somewhere in the Australian market. On slide five, I just give you a very brief overview of how did we get there to the point in 2005 where the accounting standard was changed in this way. Essentially, it was driven by the collapse of the second largest non-life insurance Australian company, which was HIH back in 2001, and all of the reforms that followed in the industry as a result of that. So if we now go to slide six, we basically see the key features of the Australian non-life insurance accounting standard, which is known as AASB 1023, which is the one that's been in place since the 1st of January 2005. You will see that similarly to the ED, it requires expected value to be used as the basis for claims liabilities, or insurance, well, outstanding claims liabilities and insurance liabilities. It does use the unearned premium income for pre-claim liabilities. It requires a liability adequacy test to be applied with a risk margin, and it requires both the expected values. If you see the term on my slide, central estimates, that's just the words used for expected value. It is the same thing in Australia. It requires both the central estimate and the risk margin to be explicitly disclosed and quantified separately on the balance sheet, and it also requires that the company disclose the probability of adequacy or probability of sufficiency which it believes attaches to the risk margin that is shown on the balance sheet. It also requires certain other disclosures which are listed there. Probably also importantly to understand, it is a standard that applies to insurance companies, and so it actually explicitly requires insurance companies to hold their assets at market value, and all assets are marked through the profit and loss account. So the Australian industry and the life insurance industry in Australia is the same, are completely on a mark-to-market basis for all of their assets and have been for quite some time. I think I'll pass slide seven because it essentially is just comparing that with ED, which I know you're all familiar with. And just to ensure that everyone understands on slide eight, there is actually a second accounting standard, which is known as Australian Accounting Standard AASB 1023, which specifically applies to life insurance as opposed to non-life insurance. And it is slightly different. And indeed, it doesn't actually include a requirement for risk margins. However, both the non-life and the life insurance standards both require what essentially are risk-free discount rates to be applied in their frameworks, although the life insurance standard over the years has come to be interpreted as allowing a small margin over and above that, which is incredibly similar to what is now being called in the board's discussions the illiquidity premium. So in that sense, it is very similar. I think the Australian view, for clarity's sake, would be that it is a relatively simple matter, or would be a relatively simple matter, to incorporate a risk margin into the life insurance way of thinking about things, so that effectively you integrate, or you could integrate, the non-life and the life insurance standards of accounting in Australia in that way. The main difference between the two of them really is that AASB 1023, the non-life standard, is obviously specifically designed to cater for 12-month so-called short-term contracts, whereas 1038 is clearly specifically designed to cater for contracts which have much longer lives, as typical of the life insurance industry. That is essentially the main difference between the two. I should also mention in passing that AASB 1038 actually requires effectively a composite margin, I think would be the equivalent terminology at the present time in your discussions, but very importantly, an unlocked one. And given, I think, ongoing discussions, it is also, I think, a very interesting precedent for your discussions about unlocking, because it has also been operating now for, I think, over 10 years in Australia. So there is a wealth of experience about how that works in Australia as well. I just wanted to turn now to some very basic understandings with insurance and then use a simple example to try to draw some of those out to make sure that we are all understanding the concepts that we're applying here. Essentially, insurance covers a spectrum between products which have a very readily predictable set of outcomes, usually somewhat higher frequency, that is, the probability of a claim actually occurring is higher than some others, but the severity, or the average severity expected of claims in those sorts of classes, is relatively lower. Classic examples would be motor vehicle insurance, property insurance, a relatively predictable class where short-term claims are paid relatively quickly, generally within 12 months. Or somewhat shorter. We then have at the other end classes of insurance where the frequency is much lower. It could be as low as 0.25% per annum, quite low probability that a claim will occur. But when a claim does occur, it's likely to be quite a large one. And those sort of classes typically are somewhat harder to predict and therefore are inherently riskier classes. And in the Australian context, a good example of that would be third-party bodily injury insurance in motor vehicles. Not property for motor vehicles, but the people in them. Quite a different class of insurance. That leads us also to a second degree of classification, if you like, of these policies or types of insurance. Those that generally have relatively low risk in their outstanding claims inherently. That is, once we know we've got a claim in insurance, what is the likelihood that our first estimate of that claim will be a bad estimate or a less accurate estimate? Versus some classes where, even though we know we've got a claim, trying to estimate what the ultimate amount of the claim will be is an inherently highly risky business. The extremes in that scenario would be life insurance at one end, where, generally speaking, there is a definitive sum assured. That is, if somebody dies, we know we're going to have to pay them $100,000. There's not much variability in $100,000. We know that's the sum assured. So that's actually not a very risky class at all. At the other extreme, we have something like maybe asbestos liability, where we may not be paying for 30 years, and the amount that we might actually have to pay is going to be the subject of a great deal of medical evidence and litigation and judicial review. There's obviously a big spectrum in the middle. Even compared to simple motor vehicle insurance, life insurance is relatively less risky. I'm talking about pure term type covers here. If you think about it, typical motor vehicle insurance, when the car's out there, we know it might have a 15-20% probability of having a claim in any 1 year, but we don't know when it has a claim, is it going to be just a fender bender and it's only going to be $500, or is it going to be a claim that writes the car off entirely and it's a $50,000 or $100,000 claim for a valuable car? There's clearly a much greater degree of risk inherent in the distribution of the claims outcomes in the second case. And they're the things that we're trying to measure when we start to get into attributing risk into the portfolios, and in particular, into the risk inherent in the outstanding claims liabilities in a non-life portfolio, because the greatest risk, once the cover has expired, obviously, and indeed arguably in the whole non-life insurance balance sheet, is in the amount of the outstanding claims liability that has already been incurred, but we don't actually necessarily know what amount it is. So if I just go on to the next slide, the major steps that we need to go through to measure that risk are set out on that slide. Obviously, work out the central estimate first, or sorry, the expected value. Secondly, work out what we believe the degree of variability in that is, which is normally measured by what is known as the coefficient of variation of the distribution, which is just the standard deviation of the distribution divided by the mean, or the expected value. We then need to actually decide what kind of distribution we think this is in the statistical sense. That is it normal? Very unlikely in the case of a non-life insurance claims portfolio. Is it log normal? Much more likely. Or is it a close approximation to one of those kinds of distributions? Actually, log normal is usually a pretty good distribution for most insurance classes, certainly before we worry about reinsurance covers. Having decided that, we then want to know what probability of adequacy or sufficiency do we think we want to set for the amount of the liability that we're determining. And obviously, once we know all of that, we have a good measure at that stage from the past experience of the same kinds of portfolios in the past of what we believe the expected value and the risk margin would be for a given probability of sufficiency at a portfolio level. Now, at the current ED, that's pretty much where we would stop, because the ED doesn't go on and allow for diversification between portfolios. But in the Australian case, that is allowed, and it is standard practice. And so we then assess what we believe the level of diversification between the portfolios is, and that is then built into the risk margin at the entity level, which allows us to obviously get a risk margin for the whole entity, and that can then be apportioned basically using the mathematical process which determined the size of the diversification benefit in the first place back to the individual portfolios that contributed to it. I emphasise, though, that if you're obviously not allowing diversification but simply adding up the portfolios, then so be it. Those steps would then obviously not be necessary if that was the course that you chose to go down. We can have a discussion about the rights and wrongs of that later. Just to try to really illustrate what this is all about, I thought it would be useful to try to lay out a really simple example, which is set out on the next slide. And just think about a dice that's being rolled 100 times, representing the underwriting of 100 insurance policies by an insurer in a year with 100 policyholders. So the concept here is that each policyholder has a dice, and at some time during the year they get to roll the dice. And if they get a 1, they get $1. If they get a 2, they get $2, etc. If they get a 6, however, they get no claim at all. They get nothing. And we're going to pay all the claims at the end of the year. So we know exactly 1 year after the underwriting occurs, that's when we're going to pay the claims, depending on whatever dice was rolled during the year. So obviously the probability of a claim is 5/6, and the probability of no claim is 1/6. And on the next slide there, you can see the actual mathematical calculation of the expected value, which is clearly $250. That's the expected value of that set of claim outcomes. And we can also calculate, because we know the formula to do that, the variance, which in turn gives us the standard deviation of that, which in turn allows us to get the coefficient of variation. That's just very straightforward statistics. So in this case, the standard deviation divided by the mean is 6.8%, and that is a key measure, in this case, of the variability of that risk from a basic theoretical framework. And because that particular distribution is extremely well-known one, we can tell you now, clearly the probability of adequacy, the expected value, because this one is a symmetric distribution, keeping things simple, is going to be $250. And if you wanted a probability of adequacy of 75%, this is before discounting, I should emphasise, then the risk margin will be requiring another $12. If, on the other hand, you wanted a higher probability of adequacy, such as 90%, you would have to go up to $22. That's the risk margin, being the difference, obviously, between the liability required to get the probability of adequacy that you may select and the central estimate, or sorry, the expected value. Obviously, if we then want to get the actual insurance liability according to the principles in the ED, if we assumed a risk-free discount rate of, say, 5% per annum, which happened to be about the right rate in Australia at the moment, then we simply divide those numbers by 1.05 and we have the equivalent of the claims liability that would be appropriate at the initial underwriting of those 100 policies. Now, I just thought I'd pause there because that kind of looks fairly straightforward. However, there are a couple of things that could start to go wrong. And this is, of course, where it starts to get interesting. First of all, let me just point out that I could have equally well constructed an example there where instead of saying we're going to pay $1 for a throw of one, $2 for a throw of two, etc., it could have been, well, you get nothing for a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, but you get 15 if you throw a 6. Now, the point about that is that that distribution, that game, if you like, or that set of policies, or that payer, has exactly the same mean, 2.5, or 250 when done 100 times. So the expected value would be identical. But, of course, the variance and the coefficient of variation of the second one is a lot higher. It's a much riskier contract for the insurer. And so, therefore, the risk margin will go up accordingly for the same probability of adequacy. And that's an important point to understand at the beginning. Particularly if you begin to think about this as not the throwing of a dice, but let's assume that this was sort of like a scaled-down version of a motor insurance contract, because as it happens, 16% per annum is not an infrequent frequency of getting a claim of some size on a policy. The question usually is, well, what size will it be? So it doesn't take too much imagination to see how this kind of thinking suddenly can easily be applied to typical insurance policies. At least I hope that you can understand where we're driving. Now let me just extend it a little bit further. You'll notice we didn't actually say anything about who gets to choose the dice. We didn't say the insurer had to specify which dice was used. We didn't say that a smart policyholder, if they were clever, couldn't figure out that if they used a loaded dice, they might start to stack the odds in their favour. It's quite likely, in fact, that if you've actually played this game, some smart policyholders would find loaded dice to use. And then, of course, the model we have constructed here would not be the right model. But we wouldn't know that because we're the insurer, particularly if we've been a bit sloppy with our underwriting standards. Now, of course, thinking that through, most insurers, if they said to their motor insurance clients, well, you can only drive a car that we give your you're not going to get you're not going to sell very many insurance policies. So you do have to take that kind of risk, but of course they tend to start asking lots of questions then about what kind of car are you driving, and they will charge you a premium accordingly, because that's what they're trying to do, to assess risk. So I hope you can see that, of course, extending it a little further, there's another fairly obvious underwriting risk that they would have to eliminate in their underwriting process. We've assumed in every case here that the policyholder was only getting one throw at the dice. A crafty policyholder, of course, would try to interpret the contract as, I keep throwing it until I get a five, and that was the one that counted. They're the sorts of things insurers have to worry about when they're trying to manage underwriting risk, but I digress slightly. The point I'm trying to get to is you begin to see how the theoretical model can break down, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as to how you control that and how that gets calibrated into the risk margins in a couple of extra slides. I think it was in the next slide, the key concept I wanted to get across was a fundamental issue when it comes to estimating outstanding claims for an insurer. For an insurer, there is always a period of time between when they know a claim will have occurred until they actually find out about it or they're notified about it and then finally settle it. And in long-tail classes of insurance, it's not unusual for these sort of periods to take at least 3 years or so on average to get from occurrence of the claim event to actually settling the claim. All through that period, the insurer is getting more and more information as time goes on about that claim and is able to refine their estimates about how that claim may or may not conform to patterns they've seen before. But the point being that you can't actually estimate with accuracy what the claim is going to be before you even know that it's actually occurred, let alone when you've actually been notified. So there's an ongoing process of getting more and more comfortable with what it is likely to cost. Obviously, the longer that process takes, the more risky the inherent process is. That is, the more likely it is that your initial estimate wasn't right. And that's the fundamental underlying premise as to why we need risk margins built into outstanding claims reserves, because clearly there is a risk that the claims will exceed your expected values. This next section may be self-evident, but I'll run through it quickly anyway. So why does all this matter? I'm now on slide 16. Typically, if you've got long-tail classes where the claims liabilities on the balance sheet are in the order of three times the premiums, the reported annual profit before tax from that portfolio will be extremely sensitive to the size of the outstanding claims liability or adjustments therein. And as the example on that slide shows, a relatively small change in the liability of even, say, 1% could easily mean a change in the reported profit of 30%. It doesn't take very much to be 1% wrong on an outstanding claim estimation. So you can see how sensitive the profit would be. An example from QBE's own balance sheet, these are published numbers from the end of December last year, roughly 1% change in insurance liabilities would represent about a 17% change in their reported profit. So just coming back to the example I started to outline earlier with the dice that might or might not be loaded, there are three fundamental types of risks that we're trying to measure when we measure an outstanding claims liability. The first, sometimes called internal systemic, but probably more commonly model specification error, basically relate to whether or not the actuarial model, in the case I mentioned earlier, the throwing of the dice, assuming it was a fair dice, is actually a good representation of the real-life process we're modelling or not. Are there anything fundamental about the actual model and the parameters we've assumed in it that actually don't reflect reality? Just differences in disclosure or non-disclosure of risk-sensitive information would be a good example of where that may not be quite right. We then have the second major source of risks, which generally can be called the external systemic risks. These are the ones that are generally outside the insurer's control, particularly around change of law affecting the class of insurance, change of judicial interpretation affecting the class of insurance, event risk, which can obviously be catastrophic or other, latent claim risk. Quite often claims will arise in some classes of insurance that you weren't expecting at all, things like claims for hearing loss or asbestos are classic examples of that in the past. Recovery risk, large, not insignificant parts of outstanding claims liabilities insurers generally assume that there will be recoveries from both reinsurance sources but also non-reinsurance sources. A good example of non-reinsurance recoveries would be the sale of vehicles that have been written off in accidents. Generally they are sold off for something other than zero, even if it's only for spare parts. And obviously that recovery comes in as cash to the insurance company. Where you can get those sort of recoveries, you obviously build them into the outstanding claims estimation because it's something you will actually get back. Clearly, though, you might have errors in the process of calculating what you expect in your recoveries. The actual claims management process may change along the way. For whatever reason, and that of course can create all sorts of problems if you are measuring the progress of your claims through the system one way, somebody changes the IT system, for example, which means that the claims are being measured in a different way as they progress through your system. Sometimes that can cause significant changes. And the third major source of risks that we're trying to deal with here are what would generally be called independent risk, which could also be thought of as just pure random statistical fluctuations, which obviously as if you have a relatively small portfolio, you will tend to have a larger proportion of that inherent independent risk in the portfolio. As the portfolios get larger and larger, the law of large numbers kicks in and that element of the risk starts to reduce. And we'll come back to that point a little later. So in actually quantifying all of this, there are still essentially, going back to those key steps I mentioned on the earlier slide, essentially the need to get a measure of the expected liability in the first place, then a measure of the variance in that liability, and then decide by looking at the patterns of claims for the relevant portfolios or similar portfolios in the past, what you believe the distribution, the type of distribution is for the outstanding claims. Once you basically have those three decisions made, it's then a relatively straightforward mechanical process to decide for a given probability sufficiency that you're looking for what the risk margin should be. And the next couple of slides on 21 and 22 really just give you a picture of that process for typical types of distributions. And it just illustrates on 22, we have there two different types of portfolios which happen to have the same mean, but they have very different coefficients of variation. And you can see, therefore, that the one which is an inherently much less risky portfolio where the coefficient of variation is only 15%, everything is bunched much more tightly around the mean and therefore the risk margin is a much smaller amount than for the other portfolio there where the coefficient of variation is 30%. So the risk margin by definition has to be a larger amount even if the total volume of these two portfolios is the same and the mean is the same. You'll get a very different risk margin even though you've got the same probability of adequacy. So what has all this meant in practice in Australia? If we go to slide 23, what you've got set out there in a table are a set of percentages which are risk margins on a standardised basis as they are actually reported in Australia by all the companies operating in Australia to the regulator. Now, the first thing you need to understand here is that the regulator requires, for their purposes only, that they have risk margins reported to them at a 75% probability of sufficiency. I emphasise most strongly that the vast majority of companies do not report their public accounting standards under AASB 1023 at 75%. Most of them choose to use a higher percentage. But for the regulator, they report the 75% equivalent number, for want of a better word. In other words, the coefficient of variation portfolio by portfolio is the same. They have simply chosen, because they're required to by the regulator, to report in this case at 75%. What you see there, in essence, if you look at the column headed liability-weighted risk margins mean, are the actual risk margins by major class of business, where each of those classes are broadly categorised into lower risk, medium risk and higher risk, which is essentially described by the length of time it takes to settle the claims or the tail of those classes of business. And you'll see there also the number of insurers that are represented in all of those numbers. That's the number of insurers actually operating in Australia in that class monitored by the regulator. Now, the liability-weighted risk margin is obviously all of the risk margins weighted by the respective liability size of the liabilities in each company and averaged on that basis. And the standard deviation is simply the standard deviation of that number. So it's just a measure of how much variation there is between all the companies. And as you can see there, if you focus on just the liability-weighted ones for the moment, standard deviations in the order of 2, 3, 4%, maybe up to 7% is, I think, the highest one for the long-tail classes. That means there's a lot of consistency. That's basically saying that the companies are now pretty heavily grouped by portfolio as to what they are reporting as the size of the variability in those portfolios. And you can see it does vary by portfolio. The other two columns, by contrast, are the simple average risk margins for exactly the same business and the same companies on the same basis. That is, simply take whatever was reported by the companies, add it up and divide by the number of companies. Now, you will see there that they are rather different numbers, and indeed in most cases are much larger numbers. And the reason, of course, is that small insurers, because they have smaller portfolios, those portfolios are inherently more risky, and therefore they are reporting, in some cases, considerably higher risk margins for the same class of business. And because you are moving in that statistic, the weighting by size of portfolio in the industry as a whole, and you're simply taking the simple average of everyone reported, you naturally get much more variability as shown in the standard deviation of that statistic. So if you're looking at the industry as a whole, weighted by the size of the insurers, the first two columns are the most relevant. If you're interested in looking at it, just simple averages, irrespective of how big each company is in that class of business, then the two columns on the right are the more relevant ones. I think the important point about that is that the regulator has basically done this comparative exercise twice and published the results to the industry. This was the second time they did it, as at the end of June 2007. From memory, they also did it at the end of June 2004. And what they found when they did it in 2007 compared to 2 years later, was that there had been a significant coming together or increased consistency in the results being reported, and in particular the divergence in the risk margins themselves being reported at a standardised probability of adequacy had dropped a lot. So in other words, consistency had improved a lot. And the other thing, of course, to bear in mind here is that these are all being reported by all companies in the industry, including the small ones. I think slide 24 essentially just makes the point that as this process has matured in Australia over the last 6 years, there is no doubt that both disclosure has improved a lot. transparency has improved and consistency between companies has improved. Analysts have found it much easier to compare companies. In particular, analysts have become very interested in understanding, in fact, requiring companies to tell them if a company moves its probability of adequacy reported from, say, 89% to 91%, and this is not an uncommon event, or the other way, they're effectively required now to tell the analysts how much that meant in terms of profit, because obviously if they go from 89% probability of adequacy to 91% probability of adequacy, and the accounting standard requires them to disclose that, that means that the liability is increased, and by dollar for dollar, the profit that they've reported is obviously decreased by the same amount. So analysts now have a feel for each company of when they do that, what that meant to the reported profit. And that's actually been a very powerful tool in the hands of analysts to really get a much better understanding of what's really going on. Whereas previously, of course, companies have tended to make those changes but have not had to report them, and therefore analysts have found it very difficult to understand what is going on. That just doesn't happen anymore in Australia, and I think that's a really important part of understanding how this works. I emphasise that, you know, the exposure draft also does require the same disclosure, and I think that's really quite important. In fact, I think it's the disclosure which is really powerful in driving the consistency and comparability. It also means that if you're looking at year-to-year comparisons for the companies, they are much easier, obviously, to understand if you're an analyst or a user. Interestingly, it also means the companies get managed a different way because they know they've got to report that, and therefore they start to manage their portfolios in such a way as to ensure that they can report numbers that they feel comfortable with. It has actually, I believe, improved the way in which the industry is run. I should just say, with the benefit of some experience here, when we first started on this journey, the regulator actually required it first before the accounting standards in 2003. And because Australia was the first country in the world, I believe, to require explicit disclosure of risk margins, you know, to the dollar, it focused a lot of attention on how do you do that, what kind of methodology do you develop to do it, and it would be fair to say at the time there wasn't an awful lot of literature around or standards in the actuarial world that allowed one to simply take something off the shelf and say, oh, here's how it's done. Having said that, I think a lot of work has been done, particularly by the Institute of Actuaries of Australia, in that period, since about 2002. And obviously driven in part by the failure of a major company, which meant that things just had to change. And so a fair bit of work has gone into getting to the point where how you do that sort of thing is actually now a lot better understood. Indeed, not just in Australia, the International Actuarial Association set up a risk margin working group, which published quite a comprehensive paper on all of this subject back in 2009. So that knowledge is now disseminating quite widely, and of course has also been driven by developments in Europe in Solvency II. So the benefits of all of this, if I'm now on slide 26, I think it actually has extended a lot of rigour into the way the businesses are being managed. It's probably made actuaries more influential in the management of insurance in Australia, in non-life insurance particularly. It's meant that there's more focus on the data that goes into these calculations, and it means that both management and boards have become more focused on what does this all mean and how do we get ourselves into a position where we can competently report a set of accounts that actually makes sense, that, you know, the users, we can actually respond when the users start asking awkward questions about, if I can put it that way, because that's clearly what does tend to happen. On slide 27, I make the point that the results, yes, they will be volatile. Unfortunately, insurance is a volatile business, so sometimes you get volatile results. It is important, though, to understand in the Australian context, obviously, when you're discounting liabilities with a risk-free rate of return, as we do in Australia, the liabilities will move up and down with movements in interest rates. And when you've got assets that also move up and down with market values, as we do in Australia, a large part of the economic volatility does get taken out. However, during the global financial crisis, it is certainly true that when credit margins started moving around for the asset side of the balance sheet, there were a number of P&L hits taken, obviously, which then, of course, started to reverse themselves as the global financial crisis started to die down and credit spreads came back. I think the attitude in Australia to this now is, well, that's part of life. We explain it to our investors, you know, as we have to, and life goes on. I think it'd be fair to say there would be very, very little appetite at all in Australia, in the life or the non-life insurance industries, for moving away from valuing all assets at market value. I'll just mention that in passing. It's also fair to say that... was that a comment or a question?
No, it's okay.
It's also fair to say that because all of this gets quite thoroughly audited, and it's normal practice for the auditing firms to have their own actuaries go right through all of the calculation of the risk margins, basically it's very difficult to get any kind of result smoothing going on, and it's really quite difficult to get much manipulation of the profits going on. So the process is fairly rigorous, I think is probably the word I would use. I'll just mention very quickly a couple of the other things that are required in Australia. The next slide there you'll see is an actual reprint from Insurance Australia Group's accounts at the end of June 2010. That's required in the Australian disclosure. It's actually the claims development table. What it's actually showing you, if you look back at 2002, each year it's showing you for that year of business what the outstanding claims were originally estimated at, and then each year how that moved. That's without discounting, and it's without risk margins as well. So it's a very much a focus on the expected values. And obviously, by looking at that and whether it moved up or down dramatically from year to year, you get a pretty good feel for how good the company is at being able to estimate its liabilities over time. And you can see at the bottom of the table the reconciliations for the amounts by now actually paid out in claims, the amount of risk margin that attaches to what's left, and the discount which then applies to get to the total outstanding claims figures. Although I know I'm probably running a little long on time, I do want to make one other fairly important point. Everything I've talked about so far today has been about calibrating to a particular probability of adequacy or probability of sufficiency that you choose. It is very straightforward to recalibrate, if you want, to effectively use the cost of capital method to decide what the equivalent probability of adequacy or sufficiency should be for a given portfolio. Once you know particularly the distribution, the duration of the expected runoff, and the coefficient of variation of that portfolio, you can basically predict, if I want to go to the cost of capital method, then for that portfolio I will need probability of adequacy of X to get to the equivalent cost of capital. And you'll see basically on the following pages there, slides 30 and 31, some typical results. It basically depends very much on the inherent riskiness of the portfolio to begin with. In short, simple terms, if we go to slide 32, typical short-tail portfolio, the cost of capital will be roughly equivalent to somewhere in the vicinity of 60 to 70% probability of adequacy, probably, certainly in the Australian context at the present time. At the other extreme, long-tail portfolios are probably 80 to 90%. So if you had a mixture of portfolios, it might be somewhere in the ballpark of 75% overall. But it does obviously depend on the actual portfolios. I won't dwell on diversification, given that it's not a feature of what the exposure draft is. I'm talking about diversification between different types of portfolios there. The figures on slide 33 were just one example from a typical company in Australia. I should just obviously mention that as the portfolio probability of adequacy rises, obviously, so does the extent of diversification. That's just a mathematical outcome. And I won't dwell on the other forms of disclosure that are typically required in Australia because I think I've already mentioned them. So in conclusion, I hope you'll see from what I've described that essentially it's very difficult in insurance to always have a simple black and white outcome. There will always be the risk that the claims will exceed your best estimate of what you really thought expected value they were going to be. And therefore there is an element of grey rather than black or white in the outstanding claims liability estimation. And in my opinion anyway, quantifying the risk margins, A, is very possible, B, it's been demonstrated, it's certainly a process that is rigorous and robust and has been applied now by both large and small insurers in Australia for 6 years. And it does add meaningfully to the comparability and consistency that's reported by companies when teamed with appropriate disclosure. So I think I'll leave it there at this stage, other than to just mention, obviously, the slides have some references for reading.
Thank you very much, Tom. Board members, staff have questions or comments? Al?
Question for Tony. Tony, on your slide 27, you talk about results tend to be volatile, but so is the business. If you were to take a comparable Australian insurance company to a company that doesn't follow the same accounting rules, something outside of Australia, do you see any notable premium or discount in the valuation of the company? That may be a little bit of an unfair question, but what I'm looking for is, you know, does accounting really matter in terms of how the market assesses the valuation of an Australian company versus a company outside of Australia that follows different accounting principles that aren't as transparent?
I think the short answer is yes, the accounting does matter. And I guess the comment I would make is that there are basically three major companies in Australia which are fully listed companies and which raise their capital essentially on international capital markets, not just Australian capital markets. The three big ones, basically QBE, Insurance Australia Group and Suncorp. And so each of them have a routine process where essentially they do international roadshows for all investors internationally in their stock every 6 months, and the chief executive, as is fairly common for these sorts of things, travels, you know, widely for a couple of weeks around the world to go and talk to all his investors and explain his latest set of results. It would be fair to say the companies, I think, have now successfully explained to many investors why the Australian system is different to anything else they've ever seen. And slowly but surely, I think there's been a growing acceptance that, yes, actually they do actually understand those results better than often they do with some others. So I'll probably just leave it at that.
Tony, it seems to me critical to assessing the risk margin across different asset classes is the assumption that you make around what the underlying distribution is and how applicable that underlying distribution is for the risk margin. It's my understanding you use the log normal distribution typically because it's a skewed distribution and that represents the typical shape of a loss function for insurance companies. However, because the central estimate is not, because underlying the whole process is not a real distribution firm specific as to the loss function for individual asset classes, but a point estimate and then blown up because of by assumption, based on a log normal distribution, it would seem to me the log normal distribution would represent certain asset classes better than others or products better than others. What my concern is, it's first of all, the distribution is not firm specific, it's by assumption. And then if you go to an asbestos or an asbestos distribution or a medical auto distribution, you would think the tail might be far more extended than along normal distribution for the very risky classes versus the more less risky classes. And so it seems a gross simplification to say all distributions of risk are log normal and that the coefficient of variation represents well what the true underlying risk structure is. And am I capturing correctly some of the simplification that has to occur in this process?
Yes and no. Let me try to explain that answer. First of all, we're talking not about asset classes here. We're obviously talking about liability insurance portfolio classes, yeah. So I better just make that clarification. Secondly, there is a spectrum of practice. Generally speaking, I think it's probably fair to say I implied that if you're a small company, you might make the simplifying assumption that it is probable that your underlying claims distribution for many of your classes probably looks pretty close to a log normal. In fact, you might even make that assumption. However, for the smaller companies, generally what they're doing is employing a consulting actuary who works for generally a number of companies who has the ability to look across different portfolios and effectively benchmark those portfolios. They won't normally just assume it's always a log normal. There are quite a few other distributions that can fit, you know, and indeed will fit better in some cases than a log normal, the particular kind of insurance you're talking about, and indeed it's quite common not to use the log normal as well. In the case of the larger companies that have a bit more resources and a bit more data and a bit more experience, they will generally use their own distributions, which may not, well, you know, quite often will not be log normal. They might look a bit like it, but they might be different. And they will have quite sophisticated stochastic modelling capability that allows them to do that and rely much more heavily on their own experience. So if I implied that, you know, you just assume it's log normal, that was probably an unfortunate implication that I left with you. Having said that, you know, it's probably not a bad first approximation for a lot of classes. There is one very important caveat, and it is an important caveat to all of that. It is important in all of this to allow for the individual reinsurance which has been put around the portfolio, which is obviously an insurer by insurer, portfolio by portfolio assessment, because the reinsurance program around the gross portfolio can have a very dramatic impact on the risk margin that is required for the net portfolio, which you're actually holding as the insurer. And so it's imperative that in any assessment of all of this, you get your reinsurance right. And, of course, it's the reinsurance part which, for many insurers, simply cuts off the extreme of the tail anyway, so that it becomes less of a problem than it might otherwise be. Unless, of course, you're like Mark and you're in a reinsurer. It's fair to say that reinsurers have to pay a lot more attention in detail to the exact distributions that they have underwritten, because theirs tend to be the more difficult ones to actually manage, or at least estimate accurately, it might be a better way of putting that. And they will tend to be the ones that are using the more sophisticated techniques because of those problems. They can't just assume standard sort of distributions because they'll probably not be. By way of example, within the company I used to work for, Insurance Australia Group, it actually had within it a sole purpose captive reinsurer which managed the reinsurance of the rest of the group before any of the group companies would reinsure outside, and that itself was a captive reinsurer of not inconsequential size. That reinsurer had a completely different risk margin and claim distribution characteristic to the rest of the group, and had to be routinely modelled in a great deal of detail, and you couldn't really assume anything about that that was standard necessarily. You had to model it from scratch. And so It was extremely skewed distribution, and indeed many reinsurers would be, much more skewed than a log normal. So I guess that's another way of saying that depending upon the actual portfolios you're dealing with, some of them, you know, you can probably estimate reasonably reliably with relatively standard distributions, but some of them you definitely cannot. And part of the actuarial professional judgment involved in all of this is knowing which is which.
And so the challenges for smaller companies are far greater in being able to, they have to be getting advice on the outside to select a distribution that might be representative, reinsurance challenging it to a great extent, but there's definitely approximations if what you're doing is using standardized distributions by reference by someone from the outside, assuming what might be the general class, general shape of the distribution, not derived from actual empirical distributions of the company. So the risk margin is far better if you have the underlying empirical distribution available to you and more spot on for your different product classes than if you have to approximate it with distributions from the outside.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and obviously there are benchmarks and practice and professional guidance for actuaries as well, I might add, that mean that it has to be generally within certain ranges that would be regarded as sensible or acceptable. Obviously in all accounting estimation as well, not just actuarial, there are estimates required for certain things. This is no different to that.
Thank you.
I'm mindful of the time. I do have a few more people who would like to ask questions. PK?
Tony, thank you for that good presentation. Picking on the point that Tom Linsmeyer just asked you, I know you're involved with India, and I remember reading that 2-3 days ago. If my memory serves me wrong, I apologize. With your involvement with India, and I wanted to find out how entity-specific you can get to get all this information that you need for explicit risk margin. And I know that I would like to understand how that is happening in India with the distribution curves and all that stuff. To get it to India, are you using the data, the logics that you're using in Australia to use it in India, or is it you're developing on your own, and what has been your experience there? And I have a second question which is related to that, but if you want to pick up that.
I'll respond to that fairly simply by saying that because it's not formally required in India at the present time, practice generally in India is less advanced in this area than it is in Australia, which is, I guess, what you'd expect. Having said that, some of the companies in India, from an internal management point of view, as opposed to a public reporting point of view, are quite well advanced and probably wouldn't have that much trouble if they were really pushed to be able to get this into their public reporting, if I can put it that way.
Okay. The second question I want to ask is that I understand this explicit risk margin has come about in Australia right after the HIH disaster in 2001. The question I want to ask is that what happened to the premiums subsequent to explicit risk margins in the non-life industry? What happened to the insurance premiums that you've been charging? Have they come down, gone up? What has been the experience?
I don't think the charging of explicit risk margins has had a huge impact in itself on the size of the premiums being charged. Over that period, there's been a whole lot of other factors that have affected insurance premiums, and indeed, insurance being a somewhat cyclical business, in Australia, premiums immediately after HH, and particularly for the classes where HH was a major underwriter, not unexpectedly rose strongly because the major supplier had been taken out of the market and supply and demand did what it normally does. The commercial classes in Australia through, from memory, about 2006 and 7 and 8 dipped quite a lot, and they're obviously major classes. So in other words, the premiums are dropping. However, they've begun to come back up again. On the retail classes or the personal lines classes, there's been quite strong premium growth over the last 4 or 5 years simply because of a whole string of issues not unrelated to significant catastrophes occurring, which are driving the claims costs up related to climate change, and therefore premiums are going up as well. So there's a whole mixture of factors in there. I don't think the fact that we're charging risk margins is really much of effect at all compared to the other factors going on.
Thank you.
Tony, thank you for that presentation. On slide 27, you indicated that the risk margins will not vary much over time as a percentage of the central estimate. And I'm assuming that that has something to do with the disclosure requirements that you talked about in terms of changes in the probability of adequacy or what have you. I would think that that tends to keep things to a central point. But then on slide 23, where you compare those two columns of the weighted averages to the simple averages, you explicitly pointed out that the smaller companies have a lot more variability in the levels of risk margins that they're setting. And I guess I'm just interested in how people really support changes in their probability of adequacies. So, and in turn, how do auditors deal with those changes? So who's to say that, you know, a 75% level is sufficient, or a 90% level is sufficient, excuse me, or what have you? And I just, while I think the information is really important, I'm having a difficult time understanding how you really substantiate why one number in one situation is appropriate and another number in a different situation is appropriate.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Can I just answer it as follows? First of all, the thing that is generally pretty stable, particularly now, is the coefficient of variation ascribed to a given portfolio will not generally change a lot over time. It will change a little bit, or obviously it'll change if you have a different reinsurance program that you change. But it's the thing that's relatively stable for a class of business. The thing that, as you point out, at the moment in the Australian framework is, quite frankly, subject to what management and the board decide to do, is the probability of adequacy that they decide they want to adopt. And obviously there's a range of opinion as to, within a company, you know, as to whether they think, you know, 85 is good enough or they want 95. I should say most companies have coalesced to pretty close to 90. That seems to have become a sort of industry benchmark. Having said that, the reason I tried to clarify earlier, if you are trying to look for an objective of what would a company expect by way of compensation for the risk that expected claims might exceed, sorry, the actual claims might exceed the expected claims in a given distribution, then that is much closer to the cost of capital kind of concept. And it's, as I explained earlier, it is fairly straightforward to actually work out, if I know this is my distribution, this is my coefficient of variation, and this is my expected duration of claims pattern, to translate a cost of capital to a given probability of adequacy. So if you were going to say that that was the objective, which is obviously potentially a coherent objective, it is not that difficult to then set down a series of internal policies effectively saying, well, for this class of business, I want this probability of adequacy, and you could even describe it as that. The point I'm trying to make is that there is a relatively straightforward translation between that kind of objective and the probability of adequacy you would require for a given type of business. That's what I was trying to say earlier. But you're right. Right now, that fundamental link is not formally made generally by Australian companies, it would not be that difficult for them to make it, I have to say. In fact, as you can probably tell, quite a few of them know extremely well, actually, because they price their business that way, what it would take. They just haven't formally linked up their accounting reporting with that yet, but they could. And that wouldn't, it wouldn't be hard.
Thank you.
Mark Siegel, last question.
Thanks, Tony. I thought that was a terrific presentation. I was particularly interested in how you discussed the information value content to the investors and the users and how you thought it enhances the transparency of the model. And I guess my question was really about the comparability between companies. And you pointed out that, and I agree, that the disclosures would be critical to making sure that there's a convergence, if you will, about the probability of adequacy, et cetera, and the sensitivity analysis associated with it. And I'm sure that analysts are going to be focused on, if there's any change, what the impact would be. And I guess what's helpful in Australia, it seems, is that there's one model that everybody's using to do a risk margin. And as you know, the ED did not prescribe a single model to do a risk margin. And I guess my question is, how would you advise us about the trade-off between the comparability that you get by having one model and the usability of it versus having multiple models of cost of capital or a model similar to Australia or another model? As this, as you point out, this world of developing risk margins is evolving.
I guess the first point I try to get across is that actually the three methodologies that you did set out for this in the exposure draft are reconcilable, and I've specifically tried to demonstrate in this presentation that effectively a confidence interval, which is what probability of adequacy or probability of sufficiency is, and cost of capital logic can be translated backwards and forwards relatively easily, certainly for non-life insurance, I believe. And it's not just my belief. I mean, the whole actuarial profession in Australia would not have a difficulty with that concept. The third one, which was set out in the paper and which is also shared in the International Actuarial Association's 2009 paper, really refers to conditional tail expectation, or sometimes known as tail VAR. It is actually essentially not that different either, really. It's just another form of the confidence interval expressed a different way. And I believe that would also be reconcilable if you put your mind to it without that much difficulty. And, that's just, a matter of opinion. But at the end of the day, it's another way of specifying where I want to draw the line along the tail of the distribution. And therefore, it should be translatable back. It's just a matter of, do I set it at 95% or 97.5% conditional tail expectation as opposed to 90% or 93% or whatever for confidence interval. It's a difference in banking terms between value at risk and tail value at risk, if you like, if you understand the distinction I'm drawing there. They're two different concepts, but they are reconcilable. I think actually, to answer your question, the really important thing, which is in the ED already, is that no matter which way you do it, you should disclose what is the probability of adequacy, or probability of sufficiency, if you want to call it that, of your estimate. That is the important thing. That's the thing that people can then hold as a quantifying number and start to ask questions of management when they're users, which forces quantitative accountability, for want of a better term. So provided that's in there as part of the disclosure, and provided the actual size of the risk margin, a dollar amount, is in there, I think they're two very important steps forward. I just make the point, too, that obviously if an insurer is writing a lot of short-tail, low-risk business, then obviously they should have a lower risk margin for a given probability of adequacy compared to an insurer that's writing an awful lot of long-tail, high-risk business. And that's one of the important things that people will better understand. You know, there are inherently less risky and more risky portfolios to be holding, and people should understand that, and that's why the risk margins should be different between them, and they will be materially different. You know, we're talking easily two or three times different for the two ends of the spectrum.
Thank you very much, Tony. Alessandro, would you please introduce our next presenters?
Yes, so our second presentation is from two representatives from Swiss Re, so Mark Swallow and Leopoldo Camera, and they will guide us through the practice at Swiss Re of determining risk margins within an economic valuation model. So, Mark.
Thank you, Alexandra. Good morning, everybody. And the slightly disconcerting thing about looking at myself on the screen, along with, I think, three other people, is that I have the least hair of all the people. It's a straightforward way to recognize me. I'm starting on slide number two, the introduction slide. Since 2002, we've been applying an internal economic framework, which we call EDM. Today, we're now using that framework for a whole range of management and reporting activities, so performance management and reporting. We also use it for pricing, so for pricing our technical business. And we do high-level summarized external reporting using this framework as well, in addition to our normal basis of accounting. EVM does use the cost of capital approach, which I think Joe talked about as well last week, so you'll recognize some of the principles here already. And for underwriting activities, so for our P&C and life and health business, the cost of capital is our estimate of what we call the frictional costs of writing risk business on the shareholders' capital. And so it's we'll talk about frictional capital costs a little bit through this presentation, but it's our way of estimating that cost of risk or risk adjustment, which we've been talking about. The next slide, number three, on EVM results. I think just to summarize here that we use this method across all of our business. So within Swiss Re, we have P&C, and life and health reinsurance. We have a large corporate risk business, and we have a life insurance runoff business called Admin Re, principally in the UK and the US. And we use this methodology across all of those businesses. And we also apply it to our investment activities as well. So one of the key things for us with this is actually consistency across our business, so we can see and compare what's going on. We also include in here all the business risks that we have identified, clearly based on significance. So we model all the significant risks identified in this process. Slide number four of the EVM framework. I think just to highlight some of the main features on the underwriting side. So we do use best estimate cash flows. And for example, for P&C, the starting point for that, so the undiscounted cash flows are the same within our economic reporting and within our US GAAP reporting. So we're starting in the same place for P&C. Clearly for life and health, because of the way US GAAP works, we start with the same cash flows, but it's not the same nominal. I guess it's the same nominal position, but the assumptions are then different on the life and health side. We discount those cash flows using risk-free rates, and we use current assumptions in the calculations. And then finally, we make the risk adjustment explicitly, so it is separate to the discounting or the best estimate calculation process. On the next slide, number five, a measurement of underwriting activities. I think Joe showed a very similar slide. So all you see here circled are the capital costs that we estimate spread over time. So we estimate capital costs for the life of our contracts, and then we bring that back to the balance sheet as a capital cost provision on day one, which then will unwind over the life of the contract. Slide number 6, a measurement of underwriting activities. This is a busy slide, so I apologize for that. But this just shows the unwind of the capital cost provision over time. This is clearly simplified, so it comes out on a linear basis here. That's not what happens in reality, and we'll see an actual example later on in the presentation. But all other things being equal, so assuming that all the best estimates on the cash flow side have worked out as expected, this is how this contract would run over time. So you can see the capital cost provision dropping out into equity part each year. Slide number 7 is our EVM income statement for all of our business up 2009. And so you can see here our segments, P&C Life and Health Asset Management. And you can see the results before capital costs for this year and then the release of capital costs for the year, giving our net result after all capital costs. So clearly here, this consistency point was key for us in developing this framework. Prior to this, we had essentially a P&C economic framework and a life and health economic framework, and we wanted to bring them together. And also, we use this for asset liability matching and for assessing underwriting and investment activities. The next slide, number 8, these are the total capital costs. So this is for the entire framework. And you can see that the one we're going to focus on is the third bullet, so what we call frictional capital costs. So this is the part which relates to underwriting risk only. And at least in principle, this is our estimate of the required return for exposing that capital to underwriting risk. I think just one thing to add, you see the second bullet are the market risk premiums that we use for investment activities. So if we do have, and clearly we do in the life and health side, a business which has market risk exposures in it as well as underwriting exposures, we will then apply the second bullet as well to calculate the total risk adjustment for those contracts. And I think this was also important to us in developing this framework, that we could, where we had both market risk and underwriting risk in the same contract, we could assess them within one framework and price them clearly within one framework. So moving on to slide 9, frictional capital costs. This is just the theory of what the frictional capital costs are. So I'm not going to walk through this in detail. It's just our way of expressing the theory. In practice, this is the way in which we reflect the risk we're exposing our capital to for insurance or reinsurance risk. So the next slide, number 10, we move down to a little bit more detail on how we actually do this. So we calculate what we call EVM capital for our various businesses and then for our treaties when we're actually pricing the treaties. We charge that capital. We use 4%, so 4% charge for the frictional capital costs. And that is then what flows through into that capital cost number and provision, which I mentioned on the previous slide. And to estimate the EVM capital, we do look at the different basis of capital that we have to apply. So for us, that's risk capital, which is our internal economic view. It is regulatory capital and rating capital. And clearly, in principle, here we would use internal economic capital, but at least today we recognize here the different capital bases that we have to manage within the firm. And we would expect this to evolve over time. In particular, some of those bases come closer together. Tony mentioned Solvency II earlier. So within Europe, Solvency II will move the regulatory framework much closer to our internal view of capital usage. Just to mention here that the dash in the boxes is not a minus, it is a dash, so I apologize for that. That's slightly unclear. But for example, regulatory capital in our calculation is regulatory capital and the statutory margins that the regulatory environment typically require you to hold over the best estimate. So we charge that as well as the regulatory capital. But in a nutshell, this is we're just using these different bases to estimate the EVM capital number. And this process can be as complex or as simple as the individual companies either do it internally or want to do it if they're applying this method to financial reporting. So on the next slide, number 11, we cover here in a little bit more detail the way that we do the risk capital part, because I guess this is clearly for us the most complex part. And in fact, I think Tony has touched on a lot of the issues here. So we use our internal risk model to work out how much risk capital we are applying to the different parts of our business. In life and health, that's typically based on factors which are then applied to the relevant measures for the different risks. And on the P&C side, we use what's called a loss uncertainty model to make the calculations which you were discussing a little bit earlier. But the outcome of this is the risk capital number, which then flows into the EVM capital, which we then charge. And I guess just to add that is it is an integrated model, so all risks are brought together in this model. And in this part, we are applying diversification to the risk capital calculations. And that is a key element, clearly, of our business model as a global reinsurer. Moving over the page to 12, rating capital, we use a model to estimate our estimate of the rating capital that's supporting the various parts of the business. And we do regulatory capital on a bottom-up basis by legal entity. So this gives us the different pieces that we need to put together our EVM capital and then apply it through the reporting framework. Now, moving to a small example of the result of that for the risk margin on slide number 13. So here is, a relatively small P&C portfolio for us. So it's within one legal entity, covers one geography, and it has one currency, and it is one type of business. But this is an actual portfolio within our EVM model, and these are the cash flows that you see on this slide, so exactly what you would expect. The premium does flow over a number of years, and we have shortened it, so we just put as many years as fitted on one slide on the page. In reality, it would run out a bit longer, but you can see from the size of the numbers that it really is the early years where the larger cash flows take place on the premium side, and then clearly the claims run off over time. On the next slide, number 14, you see the EVM capital that is allocated to this portfolio, and you see the 4% charge, which then delivers the frictional capital costs, or if the risk adjustment in the way that we do it. And again, not surprisingly, the EVM capital is heavily weighted towards the early years, because in the coverage period, the claims are being reported or initially estimated, and then we expect the uncertainty to clearly decline over time. Although, as Tony, I think, explained well, the exact profile of this will depend on the tail of the business and the nature of the business. And then moving to the next slide, number 15, you actually see this in the form of an income statement and balance sheet at the end of the first year. The yellow, if you have it in colour, highlighted lines are the pieces of the capital cost,
And in fact, you can see here from the slightly clumsy arrows that this is the bit that I added to the professionals slide. But you see the full capital charge in the income statement. You then see the release in year one. So this is the amount that was released for the first year. And then you see on the balance sheet side the provision for future years. So that's how the calculation for this example actually flows into. This is the detailed income statement and balance sheet because it shows the PV of all of the premiums as compared to the kind of summary margin for the group, which we saw on the earlier slide. Next slide, number 16, shows the EVM capital allocation by segment. So for 09 and 08, this was the amount of EVM capital that we were holding by segment. And clearly there is a little bit of complexity in doing the whole pricing process by individual treaty and then bringing the full picture together for the overall reporting for the group's results. But again, that's, I guess, mainly related to the complexity of our business and the way in which we're using our internal risk model and calculations. So finally, number 17, the summary. Whilst there are complexities in what we do, the actual input requirements are fairly straightforward. So we need an estimate of the capital which supports the risk business over time, and we need an estimate of the cost of that capital. And the estimating the capital itself will be a lot less complicated for a straightforward insurer. If it is operating a single line of business, it will only have that line of business to estimate. It will be quite complicated for an insurer like ourselves. But again, it also depends on which of those capital views you take, and that will depend on how insurers or reinsurers are actually managing the capital which they have. And the estimate of the cost of that capital is clearly judgmental, but it has to fit with the insurer's overall view or the reinsurer's overall view of their cost of capital, because it is part of that. Just to give you an example, we did apply this method when Swiss Re acquired a reinsurance business of GE in 2006. We applied it to the attribution of the purchase price, the P&C portfolio, which was quite large. That transaction closed in the 9th of June, and we reported early August our half-year results, including the purchase gap balance sheet, with this methodology applied to the purchase portfolio. We did have to make some simplifications to do that, and I guess in particular allocating the risk capital across the different lines of business. That was not straightforward, but that's just an example of where you can apply this, even if it had not been applied before to a particular portfolio, by using the techniques and principles. And finally, as certainly from our point of view, the result that you get is very valuable information about the performance of the insurance or reinsurance business. That is a key benefit from this. So thank you for your attention.
Questions, comments?
Actually, I want to ask a question to Tony rather than Mark. You know, Mark shows a simplified income statement on page 16. You didn't. I want to ask two questions about performance report, which indirectly relate to risk adjustment and directly relate to the measurement-based system. And I assume, you know, the new model, new accounting model you use from 2005 is liability measurement based, and previously you used was not. So I have two questions. One is there any major changes of performance report in your environment? And secondly, what's your view on the controversial our two boards face on what kind of performance report we should use? Should performance reports should be purely management-based or integrate some kind of premium information?
Was that to Tony or Mark?
Tony.
Is that to Tony?
Mark.
I was relaxing. That was coming your way.
I'm not sure if I got all of the question, but I think if I can try and do the second bit first, I think you were asking essentially a question about should we have a presentation which allows us to track the volume of the business via premiums going through the P&L account effectively. My personal view is the answer is yes. I think it's going to be quite difficult to for people to understand, really, or even users to understand a P&L that didn't have that information in, if I can turn it around that way. I'm not sure if I fully grasped the first part of the question, because at that point I thought it was going to Mark, so I wasn't quite as concentrating on it as I should have been.
My first question is, you know, assume your previous accounting model was not measurement-based and the new one is. Is there any changes in the performance report in Australia?
Did you change the way you prepared the income statement?
They didn't.
No, I think, the presentation didn't change. No, what changed was the explicit disclosure. Well, first of all, how the insurance liability or the outstanding claims liability in particular had to be calculated, that changed. And the presentation of that changed in that you had to disclose both the expected value or the central estimate and the risk margin, and you had to disclose them separately, and you had to disclose the probability of adequacy. And you also, I didn't mention it, but you had to disclose the claims development table in a particular way, and you also had to disclose the effect of the sensitivity of the outstanding claims estimate to some key nominated and specified assumption changes. So all of that was added compared to what was there before. The actual items on the face of the P&L and the balance sheet didn't change dramatically that I can recall.
Yeah, Tony, maybe if I could add a point. I thought at one point there, maybe this was from a regulatory perspective, there was some view that during the unexpired risk period, so rather than an unearned premium type presentation, that you would develop an explicit risk adjustment. I think the regulators started down that track. I'm not sure whether they're still there, but it never found its way into change in the financial reporting model.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, you're quite right. The regulator, for their own purposes, does have an explicit requirement to report the pre-claims liability in an exactly analogous way to the way in which the outstanding claims liability is reported, and for some time did not use conventional unearned premium, which the Australian Accounting Standard, when it was developed and implemented in January 2005, didn't go down that track for the pre-claims liability. It simply stayed with unearned premium, and that seems to have worked fine. In fact, the regulator, I think, has now pretty much come around to saying unearned premium will probably do for them as well, although that's still a slightly grey area. They're still sort of developing their own thinking in that area. What is important, though, is that the Australian Accounting Standard does require a liability adequacy test to be applied to the unearned premium, which does include, what is your expected value of your pre-claims liability with a risk margin, and is the unearned premium number bigger than that? In other words, it's not allowed to fall below it. So that test is in the Australian Accounting Standard. And if it's bitten a number of companies in the past, it's not a
a test that's necessarily easy to pass. So that, I think, is an important feature of the Australian system. But you're right, there is a subtle difference between where the regulator was for pre-claims liability for much of this period and where the accounting standard was. But obviously I was focusing on accounting standards today, so I didn't really need to go into that.
Mark, I'd like to ask about your slide 8, in which you break up the capital cost into three components. Is it possible to relate any or all of these components to our notion of risk margin or and also liquidity premium? As set out in the exposure graph.
So the frictional capital costs relate to the risk margin, as I understand it. I think with this addition, though, that if there were market risks in the underwriting business, there would be a piece of the market risk premium that would be, I assume, sucked into the risk margin to give the full picture. But if this was a pure for example, a P&C or a life and health contract, Tony mentioned term mortality, that would have no market risk in it. That would fall fully into bullet number 3.
Maybe one additional short comment on the illiquidity. We also talk about illiquidity costs in the context of our definition of capital costs to reflect the fact that shareholder funds that are located in a legal entity cannot be deployed elsewhere in the group, and that there is an illiquidity component to capital trapped in a legal entity, and that a specific charge should apply to reflect that illiquidity. But this argument is entirely separate from the illiquidity concept that relates to the possibility of investing insurance funds or assets backing insurance funds in illiquid assets for long time periods, because the insurance liabilities are illiquid. So I would say that the illiquidity concept pops up in the EVM framework in these two places, and they're separate.
Stephen?
Thanks. I've got a question for Mark, and it's about the amount of the risk margin. So my understanding is that the risk margin is determined by how much capital and what is the cost of that capital. And in terms of how much capital, you give us, this is slide 11 and 12, that it's based upon your risk capital and then rating and regulatory capital. Now, yesterday, last week, when we had Munich Re, they gave us a 99.5% confidence level for that capital. So do you have a confidence level? Is it comparable to Munich Re? What amount do you use? How do you choose it? Also, my understanding is that Munich Re used a higher cost of capital than your 4%, and they were looking at both the second and third bullet in the slide that Paul was referring to. Is that a source of a lack of comparability between the two? And also, Munich Re had a 1.75 adjustment factor, and my understanding that was partly related to ratings, and I think you're including that within the assessment of the amount of capital, and presumably the confidence interval in the first place. My question really, to sum it up, is how comparable is your risk margin with that of Munich Re?
So we use in the risk capital calculation 99% tail VaR. So that's the tail VaR that Tony mentioned earlier, and for the reasons that Tony described. So because the tail VaR estimate takes you slightly deeper into the edge of the distribution, and for the nature of our business, that is relevant to us to look at that point. And I think, as Tony also described, you do need to ask yourself whether consistency means everybody should use the same thing there. In my mind, what we're trying to get to here is a calculation that makes sense for our business and therefore delivers relevant and useful information for our business. Our business is not directly comparable, in fact, to most other reinsurance businesses in the world. I'm afraid I didn't get all of the detail of the rest of your question, but I think that yes, in the way that we estimate the different capital elements, we will take into account our target requirements for capital. So it will not simply be the 100% of the outcome of a calculation. It has to include what we expect to hold to support that business. I think that's what Joe must have been describing, but I'm not sure. So if you want to come back, I'll have another go.
Can I make a couple of observations on that question? You need to understand that obviously different insurers will adopt different risk appetites, as CIRM is commonly known, and sometimes quite deliberately set different capital targets for their ongoing operation. Some insurers are quite happy operating effectively with a single A credit rating, some quite large ones. Others, typically like the reinsurers, would probably be more comfortable with a higher credit rating, which implies that they do actually need more capital because they, in theory at least, are going to go bankrupt less often. Obviously, tends to be, if you go down that track, a little bit of compensation the other way, in that if you are more highly rated, you will probably pay just a little bit less for your capital than if you're more lowly rated. And there have been a couple of studies that show that those two do tend to offset each other quite a bit. In the natural way in which industries operate, there has to be the flexibility provided, I think, for companies to run themselves the way they want to run themselves and explicitly set the targets that they set. At the end of the day, those philosophies will flow down into the amount of capital they allocate to the businesses, which in turn will ultimately impact the pricing that they attach to those businesses for the products. The other comment I guess I'd just like to make in terms of overall comparability is that, and this is one of the reasons why I think in Australia anyway we're fairly keen on at least disclosing what the probability of adequacy is, no matter what method you may have chosen to get to that answer. The probability of adequacy will generally be somewhere, as we've discussed, in the order of maybe at the low end 60%, at the high end maybe 90%. But it's in a range where it's much easier to estimate with some confidence, if I can put it that way. Once you're out into the tail of the distribution that is like 99 or 99.5 or even higher, which is where you are normally setting the capital standard of an insurer or even higher, whether it be VAR or tail VAR, the potential for variation at the very extreme of that distribution is somewhat higher than the potential for getting it wrong down at 60 or 70 or 80%. Or at least, if you prefer, the potential for difference of opinion is higher up at that end. Depending on how skewed you think the distribution is, how fat the tail might be, those factors are less influential when you're at the 60, 70, 80% sort of range of the distribution. So whilst the cost of capital method can be used to estimate, what is a reasonable way of estimating the compensation for the risk that the claims turn out to be higher than you thought they were going to be, a more
likely to be relatively consistently reliable expression of that will be more in the probability of adequacy of the total distribution rather than in the actual calculation up at the capital end, which is sitting, depending on such an extreme value in the distribution, usually way past 99%. So that's one of the reasons why, even if you've calculated it using your version of cost of capital, we would argue that disclosing what that means for probability of adequacy is important and is therefore a important comparability measure.
Thanks, Leslie. Mark, and also Tony, in a way, when you gave us the outline of the method you used, I got the impression that you actually don't have what we are proposing as a residual margin to nullify the effect of upfront profits, day one profits. Do you take day one profits? Was that what I heard you say on new business? And is that a significant part of your profit level? And I also asked Tony after that, do you use a residual margin in Australia, Tony?
You go first, Mark.
Yeah, so David, the answer is yes to your question. We take day one profit in the EVM framework because we are that framework is looking to identify what we believe is the value added by the business that we've done.
On the statement that Mark just made, if you look at slide 5 of the pack that Mark presented, this example, this picture, shows that there's a specific contract where premium is paid up front, and claims and expenses come later, all discounted. The total premium in this example is 2,600, and the total production cost is 2,300. That production cost includes capital costs. The difference between the two is EVM profit, which is the measure of value creation in this framework that is fully recognized up front. So adds to the economic net worth immediately and fully.
That says premium received. Is that expected premiums as well?
In this example, yeah, just for simplicity, we assumed that premiums are fully paid up front. If premiums came later, we would also discount them as part of the rest of the cash flows.
What do you do with the acquisition cost then if you are taking the day one? What do you do with the acquisition cost?
The same approach is taken as for any other cash flow. It's fully costed up front.
What
are
you doing?
I can't. Do you want me to go on to answer the question for Australia, or you want to finish
yes.
that? Okay. The answer for Australia is the exact opposite. No. There is no upfront profit reporting at all in either non-life or life insurance in Australia. If I look at the non-life case first, essentially what is going on in the non-life case is that generally speaking, you get an unearned premium for the working its way through over the 12-month coverage period. And at the end of the coverage period, you've effectively got it by then a built-up outstanding claims reserve, which has its risk margin attached to it. So the risk margin is effectively the only margin after that point, if I can describe it that way. And there is a provision at the moment for in non-life insurance, you can carry a DAC. But that doesn't obviously impact the upfront profit. So essentially what's going on there is that you essentially have a risk margin. Well, you could think of it, if you like, as an inbuilt residual margin that is strictly run off over the coverage period of the contract, almost invariably 12 months, and a risk margin which is essentially most of the time anyway, except for the purpose of testing a liability adequacy test, applied to the outstanding claims provision and obviously run off with that provision. In the life insurance world in Australia, it's a little bit different. First of all, there is no risk margin, but there is the equivalent of a composite margin. It could be, of course, the sum of a risk margin and a residual margin to get the same answer, but basically it is designed so that it gets a zero profit at entry, which is obviously very similar to what the ED suggested or proposed. The difference between the Australian life insurance accounting process and what's in the ED at the moment is that the Australian accounting standard has an unlocked margin worked out on a prospective basis only, and only for non-financial assumption change. So all financial assumptions flow straight through to the P&L all the time, but for non-financial assumptions, they are allowed to effectively move the margin, the future margin, on a prospective basis only, up or down, so that any profit or loss emerging in a year that's just passed goes straight through to the profit and loss. Any difference between the assumptions at the beginning of the year and what actually happened goes straight to P&L of any kind. But if it's effectively an assumption change about what's going to happen in the future, that is effectively moved into the unlocked margin for the next period. That's the basic way life insurance accounting works in Australia, if I've summarised it in simple terms. So, but the answer to your question initially is there is no upfront profit able to be recorded at all at outset.
Thank you. We have just a few minutes left. Peter, and then I'll come.
Thanks. Thank you, Mark and Tony. Two quick questions. One to follow up on Paul's original question. On slide 9, the three components of the EEM group capital costs. The way I understand that, I think that's consistent with the ED, which is that the second bullet talking about the market risk premium is incorporated directly by using market-consistent inputs for things like interest rates and equity prices. And then the thing you have to model explicitly through the cost of capital approach in your case is the frictional costs in the third bullets. So I just wanted to check whether I understood that correctly. My other question was about a comment that Tony made. He implied that it's easy to translate to and from a confidence level approach and cost of capital approach and the conditional tailwind approach. Be interested in your perspective on that and whether that's equally true across all business types, life and P&C and reinsurance. And what I'm thinking of there particularly is the disclosure proposal we had in the ED, which said that if you didn't use a confidence level approach, you had to translate that into a confidence level equivalent.
So, Let's take the second one first, because I can't remember the first one, so I'm sorry, Peter, you'll have to repeat it for me. I think I heard it right, but I'm not absolutely sure. So the second one, well, Leopoldo can correct me, I'm not sure we've actually tried to translate one into the other, have we, internally?
Yeah. I listened very carefully to Tony saying that he thought a mapping could be made between the framers, and because I share that belief. You characterized it as belief as well, Tony. But I share it, so I think it can be done. But we haven't tried.
We've not actually done it. So, Peter, that is one thing that we probably could get you a little bit more feedback on internally, if you would like. We could pick that up afterwards. And I am sorry, could you repeat the first question?
Yeah.
You're asking me to confirm something.
I'll try and speak more directly into the mic as well, which might help. On slide 9, you've got the three components of the group capital costs. And my understanding is that the frictional costs are the ones that you have to include explicitly through the cost of capital approach. And the market risk premium component in the second bullet would be built in just by using market-consistent inputs. So market-consistent interest rates, market-consistent equity prices, market-consistent option prices. And that you wouldn't have an explicit risk adjustment relating to that. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Last question. Just like to confirm my understanding and going back to a previous question, risk or residual margin, I understand that the EBM concept is supplementary to Swiss GAAP financial reporting. So you're including or you're upfront recognizing the risk margin here, which is not what you're doing for Swiss GAAP let's say, traditional financial reporting. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, our external reporting basis now is US GAAP. So that's our accounting basis. This is supplementary information that we give out.
Okay, thanks.
Leslie, can I just ask if, Peter, did you ask Tony to come back on that disclosure issue of probability about constituency? Because I think it's rather critical, because we actually had that in the ED. We've had a lot of pushback on it. Mm-hmm. It seems Tony thinks that's crucial in order to get a basis of comparability.
Well, it seems he did, and he seems to think it would be easy to translate in that direction, or I have the impression I'm trying to read Tony's mind at 3,000 miles. That he was maybe talking about policy life.
Yeah, maybe I just should clarify the word easy there, Peter. I think what Warren said about it being important is right. I don't think there's any doubt that that disclosure is absolutely vital in our experience in Australia. I don't think I could really emphasise that strongly enough. I honestly do think that it is, I would describe it as relatively easy actually to go from probability of adequacy to cost of capital and back again. I don't think those two are really that difficult, and I know Australian companies have done it. I mean, they know what the answers are. The one that might be a little bit harder, but I believe it is certainly doable, is using the conditional tail expectation or the tail bar, whichever you prefer to call it. At the end of the day, if you'd really believe that you know roughly what your actual distribution is, you should be able to translate. It's really just another form of describing the tail of the distribution, or taking another point at which you're going to draw the line, if I can put it that way. So I cannot see why it should be that difficult to make the translation essentially between tail bar on the one hand and probability of adequacy, if you like, or essentially the terminology in banking world is the difference between value at risk and tail value at risk. So there's the concepts are the same as probability of adequacy versus conditional tail expectation. There's really no reason why you can't make the translation, provided that you have a view about the distribution. It is probably fair to say that for some kinds of insurance, people might feel more comfortable about starting out from, say, a tail bar orientation and developing their thinking from there, and I have no difficulty with that. It's just that at the end of the day, they should be translatable.
I think we find
people
it
just
very
have to put
helpful.
Their minds to it, quite frankly.
I think it'd be very helpful if you could articulate how you would do that translation.
Well, Tony, this is possible.
I'm happy to put down a very short note.
Isn't it true that the ability to do that is highly dependent on understanding what the underlying distribution is? So if a user doesn't know what the underlying distribution is that's being used to develop the risk margin, that translation becomes far harder.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that.
So maybe those of you very interested in this can take that offline.
Can I just make the obvious observation that if you're that uncertain about your distribution and your underlying business, that means you're very uncertain about the amount of capital you should have allocated to it, and you're very uncertain about the price you should be charging for it. There's a certain...